All right, let's launch right into Romeo and Juliet. I'm sure that you all know this play, at least tangentially, if not very familiar with the play itself. It's such a cultural landmark that we all know what happens to the title characters even before we read or watch the play. It's frequently staged, as it should be. It's a good play. It was the most popular play until the 20th century when it was surpassed only by Hamlet. I've heard it said that there is always a production of Hamlet happening somewhere in the world at any given time, and Romeo and Juliet is only a little bit behind that. It's been translated into numerous other languages and performed in non-English-speaking countries from France to Tibet. There are at least 15 film versions that I know of and many paratexts or spin-offs, 8 operatic versions, for example, 1 symphony, 1 overture, West Side Story from 1957, one of the great musicals of all time, and Goodnight Desdemona and Good Morning Juliet, which some of you may remember from the Belfry Theater back in 1989. And there are many pop songs that cite Romeo and Juliet as the quintessential lovers. It's jam-packed with quotable and memorable lines. I remember reading Romeo and Juliet for the first time in my teens and thinking, oh, he's not very original at all. I quickly learned that he came up with these great phrases. Star-crossed lovers, the first recorded uses in the Oxford English Dictionary attributes that to Shakespeare. Did my heart love till now? Romeo's rhetorical question upon seeing Juliet, which usually gets a bit of a laugh, especially in productions that give us a Rosaline, which I understand this production is going to do, so we get to see the competition tonight. He jests at scars that never felt a wound. That's Romeo to himself about Mercutio's jokes just before the balcony scene. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other word would smell as sweet. Or name in some editions, because the early texts have an optional different word there. That's Juliet. Parting is such sweet sorrow that I shall say goodnight till it be morrow. I often say that to my 3-year-old son, who has a really hard time letting go at night. Start them young. Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Much parodied line in later drama and famously misunderstood. I'm sure you all know that it doesn't mean, where are you, Romeo, but why do you have to be Romeo rather than some other name? There's a long history of misunderstanding. There are many stories of inebriated playgoers in the 18th century shouting, under your balcony! And a plague on both your houses, Mercutio's famous last line. If you've seen Shakespeare in Love, a brilliant movie written by Tom Stoppard, you will know that Shakespeare allegedly borrowed that line from a Puritan preacher who was inveighing against those two houses of iniquity, the theater and the curtain. Well, given its popularity and longevity on the stage, it might come as a bit of a surprise to you that Romeo and Juliet is actually an experimental tragedy. It was radically new, and it was an experiment that was not repeated very often. Now, the story of Romeo and Juliet, you need to know, is not new. It had been around for about 200 years in various forms in Europe, but not in dramatic form. It was a popular love story in Italy, told in prose or long verse narratives, particularly baggy romances with plenty of scope for elaboration, delay, moralizing, punishing the bad and rewarding the good. In Shakespeare's immediate source, Romeo and Juliet, 3 months of clandestine trysts before the duel. Shakespeare only gives them one night, alas. That source was a poem translated from the French into English by Arthur Brooke in 1562, The Tragical History of Romeus and Juliet. And it's an explicitly didactic or educational poem. Romeo and Juliet is meant to be a negative example to the reader of what might happen to young people if they disobey their parents, act impulsively, go to confession, take up with meddling Catholic friars, and trust the advice of bawdy nurses. Well, Shakespeare took this story and was the first playwright to turn the story or any story like it into drama. what a radical idea. You know, it sort of came on the London scene like Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman came on the American theater scene. What is this, a tragedy about two young people? That's not what tragedy's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about great characters, kings or statesmen who fall from positions of power and authority through their own pride or ambition. What do we have here? We have a series of really unusual features fusing prose romance with the conventions of stage tragedy. A love story, an unconventional subject for a tragedy. It's also very unusual to have a pair of tragic heroes, although Shakespeare seems to have liked the formula because he went on to Troilus and Cressida and Antony and Cleopatra in the early 17th century. Our tragic heroes, Romeo and Juliet, are very young. Children by our standards, 13 going on 14 in 2 weeks, and Romeo seems to be about 16. It's very difficult to pinpoint a tragic flaw in either Romeo or Juliet. Some people have suggested that they exhibit poor judgment, impulsivity, but these are normal qualities for teenagers. There are many references to fate or accident in the play, and that seems to be what besets our heroes in this play. The plot turns on accidents of timing, the worst of which is the miscarriage of the friar's letter to Romeo, so that he never receives the news that Juliet's first death is a fake. And finally, it's unusual to have such a busy, bustling world as the surroundings for our heroes. Tragic heroes are usually isolated from society, whereas Romeo and Juliet are firmly located in a community of family, friends, servants, and rulers. In fact, we start in the streets of a very busy city, and by the middle of the first scene of the play, almost everybody who is going to appear in the play has already appeared in a great street brawl. So the characters are not isolated until late in the play. I would suggest that it's not until the very final scene that Juliet herself is isolated, when the friar leaves her alone in the tomb to take her life if she chooses to do so. So let me suggest a generic redefinition for this strange tragedy. I would like to call it a commie tragedy. You've all heard of tragicomedies, tragedies that turn out comically. I'd like to call this a commie tragedy, a comedy that goes wrong. The play begins in the comic mode and has every potential for a happy resolution. So let's talk about comedy. Love is more properly the subject of comedy. It should lead to a happy ending. It has a typical comic conflict. Parental opposition to a love match is a very common theme in comedy. Particularly in this period when choice in marriage was not the norm. There's a cluster of plays in the 1590s giving us young lovers who wish to make their own choice against the will of their parents. So clearly this was a hot topic in the 1590s, and indeed how marriages were formulated and negotiated was in transition in this period. You might think of about A Midsummer Night's Dream, where Hermia wants to marry a man of her own choice. In such conflicts, parents concede to their children's choice at the end of the play. And in fact, in one version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, the father, Aegeus, isn't even on stage at the end of the play. His lines are given to the master of the revels. Typical comic actions include celebration. We have a great feast at Capulet's house in Act 1, Scene 5, one of the best dancing scenes in Renaissance drama. Fun to rehearse, I'm sure. Wedding preparations for the marriage to Paris, and all of the bustle and activity is transformed into a funeral, which I kind of like because the mixed genre of the play is enacted right in small in that moment when the musicians are hired for the wedding are dismissed. But even then, the comic mode is maintained because Peter, Potpan, and the musicians joke with each other, and Peter is left alone at the end of the scene mourning the loss of the music, not Juliet. Too bad she died. Now I don't get to hear the band. Some productions cut that. We shall see. It's a fun moment if it's still there. The mood of the play is definitely comic. The bustle of the community is very much part and parcel of comedy. There are a lot of earthy elements in this play, particularly the nurse, who's famous for her loquacity and her concern with the body, particularly sex and procreation and breastfeeding and all those sorts of things. Capulet himself, who should be a fairly serious representative of the social order, calls for every lady unplagued with corns to dance. You know, a reminder that even in this ballroom scene, you might be thinking about the pain in your feet. There are some fun jokes at the expense of the older generation. And this is kind of an interesting play to teach. I mostly teach 18 to 22-year-olds, and they do tend to think of the older characters in this play as old people. But there is a suggestion that Lady Capulet is less than twice Juliet's age, which would make her about 25. Anyway, which may in fact explain the next joke. Capulet calls for his long sword in Act 1, Scene 1, and his wife says, a crutch, why call you for a sword? So she may see her husband as old. I should note that there are two duel scenes in the play, and I do see them as bookends. The opening duel is relatively harmless. There's a lot of comedy in that scene, although a production may choose to make it darker through staging choices. And then you have the tragic duel in Act 3, Scene 1, where Mercutio and Tybalt are killed. All right, so I think this fusion of genres is signaled right from the very beginning of the play in the opening chorus. The chorus, where somebody comes out and gives you a setup, is not a device that Shakespeare used very often. He turned to it throughout Henry V, and he has two choruses in Romeo and Juliet, one before Act 1 and one before Act 2, and then he drops the device. It's a fascinating contradiction between form and content. In this case, the choruses in Henry V are in blank verse or rhyming couplets. The choruses in Romeo and Juliet are a very particular poetic form known as the sonnet, a form that I'm sure you all know. It's the traditional form for love poetry, and by Shakespeare's day, it was overworked and highly conventionalized. And I know that playgoers would hear the sonnet form in their ear, that rhyme scheme, A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G, that we all learned in high school, is so embedded in the Renaissance ear that they would recognize that chorus as a spoken sonnet. Shakespeare was working on his own sonnet sequence around the time that he was writing Romeo and Juliet. Both the play and the sonnet sequence date from what we call his lyric period. Romeo and Juliet's full of sonnets. In fact, it's full of broken sonnets. So you can start to map out the ABAB rhyme scheme, and you might get 12 lines or 9 lines of what might be a sonnet. And there are a couple of complete sonnets in the play. The best one being, if I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle sin is this, in Act 1, Scene 5, when Romeo and Juliet meet. And it's an absolutely stunning scene. The very first thing they speak to each other is a shared sonnet. And it's one of the most original sonnets written in the period. Otherwise, the sonnet form was highly conventionalized. It was becoming a bit stale. So we're used to seeing references to love as a disease, love as burning and freezing simultaneously, love as war, the lover as a book to be read, the lover as a ship lost on the ocean who can never make his way to port. If you can work out the puns there, you're absolutely right. Love as madness. And all of those stale conventions we see in Romeo's early poetry about Rosaline. More about that anon. The content of the first sonnet, that chorus, it's not about lovers. It's about two households, both alike in dignity. And it's full of references to fate, stars, destiny. So we have the chorus, traditionally from the tragedy of fate, speaking a sonnet, traditionally the form of love poetry, and the content tells us that we're in the world of fate. Then we move into Act 1, Scene 1, very much in the comic ethos, with the young men punning in a very aggressive and sexually cognizant way. And we get about 2.5 acts of that kind of mood, and then the play shifts to this ghoulish nightmare in which all the young people die. What happens when this comic ethos fails? Well, we get this terrible sense of waste, a certain indignation that they should die so young. And this play wastes the lives of young people extravagantly. It's not just Romeo and Juliet. It's also Paris and Mercutio and Tybalt, who are lying dead on the stage at the end of the play. Almost all the young people that you've seen are now dead. Who is going to carry on this community? A very simple rule of thumb for comedy and tragedy is that comedy renews the natural order of things, and tragedy frustrates it, stops it. A story that I particularly like from the Buddhist tradition applies very well in this case. A man went to a Buddhist monk when he was building a house, and he asked the monk for a blessing that he could hang up in his house. And the monk took a pen and wrote beautiful script on a scroll. Father dies, man dies, son dies. And the house builder said, "What kind of blessing is that? I don't want something about death on my walls." And the monk said, "Well, would you have it any other way?" And Romeo and Juliet kills off its young people. We accept death. Death happens. But it's very hard to understand the death of children. On the whole, then, it's a community tragedy in which those who fall are not so much the young lovers, but their elders who are brought down by their own pride and folly and never get to see the promise of a next generation. Capulet mourns the loss of my only hope, his only child. He will never have grandchildren. The play ends with another quasi-sonnet as Capulet and Montague join hands and each promises to raise a statue to the other's child. The piece at the end of the play is, at best, a glooming piece. By having comic potential and denying that potential, developing its conflict in a tragic way, the play exposes the riskiness inherent in the comedies. Happy endings are precarious. Conflicts are always in danger of not being resolved, of leading to more violence. Let me get more specific and suggest that the pivot of the play is Mercutio's death. We talk a lot about Romeo and Juliet. I like Mercutio. And not just because my husband played Mercutio at one point. Mercutio is a Shakespearean invention. There's no precedent for this character in his sources other than the name. It's always useful to consider how Shakespeare adapts his sources. It can give us really powerful insight into what he's trying to accomplish. Does he expand or shorten the time frame? Which characters does he emphasize? Does he add or subtract characters? Some of Shakespeare's best characters actually have no sources. Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, and I tend to think of those characters as being the heart of their plays, the ones who really give us access to what the play is trying to do. The Queen Mab speech is given to Mercutio. "Oh, I see Queen Mab hath been with you," he says to Romeo when Romeo is expressing his lovesickness. And it's an interesting speech. It's often cited in my field when people are talking about how women were perceived as witches and bawds. I think the point I'd like to make tonight is that Mercutio feels betrayed by Romeo's lovesickness, his attention to Rosaline, or more generally to women. And so he maps his sense of hurt onto the female principal, Queen Mab. And what that suggests to us tonight is that male friendship is very important in Romeo and Juliet. In the sources, Arthur Brooks' poem in particular, Romeo doesn't interact or socialize with male friends the way he does in Shakespeare. In this play, we have a lot of attention to Romeo's friends, to Benvolio and Tybalt, and they play in two really important ways, swordplay and wordplay. Both are highly skilled forms of play. Male friendship is enacted through wordplay, and male competition is enacted through swordplay. The physical aggression is displaced into hostile language, and sexual appetites are displaced into body language. And one thing that you might note is that prolonged wordplay delays swordplay by taking its place. So the longer you talk, the less likely you are to die. And, you know, these being young men in July, you know, somewhere between 15 and 18 years old, say, you can probably imagine that a lot of the puns that are happening when swords are being flourished are phallic in nature. If you hear that pun, you're right. So a major point of interest in the first scene is the juxtaposition of wordplay and swordplay. It's like a badminton game. How long can you keep the pun in the air? And much of the pleasure and purpose of the play outside the romantic scenes derives from wordplay. This is the Renaissance equivalent of special effects, right? Firecrackers and lighting. They couldn't do that. So it's the language. Unfortunately, it takes place in language that's increasingly alien to us. Comedies are actually less accessible to us than tragedies because they indulge more in this very topical, colloquial wordplay. And if we want to get it, we have to read our footnotes. It's hard to read a footnote when you're watching a production. However, I think you can still enjoy it because you don't need to know the exact velocity of the ball to appreciate the skill in a Wimbledon match. So you're going to watch a verbal Wimbledon match tonight. And enjoy that. So I invite you to pay special attention to the language. Enjoy the sport of words flying back and forth between skilled wordsmen. And in fact, wordplay is a major form of sociability in this play. If you're a good friend, you play with words with your friends. Mercutio says to Romeo, after engaging him in a bit of body badinage in 2-4, the morning after he meets Juliet, "Why is this not better than groaning for love? Now thou art sociable, now art thou Romeo." You know, you've come back to yourself by playing with words with us. When we come to the tragic duel scene, Mercutio seems to be trying to engage Tybalt in this kind of wordplay. He seems to be trying to make friends with him in the only way that this play seems to allow young men to make friends. You know, engage in some aggressive sexual punning, and then, you know, we don't have to have a fight. Tybalt has no sense of humor whatsoever. He fails to understand the puns. He doesn't communicate. He doesn't dialogue. He doesn't play with Mercutio, and at that point the play breaks down into violence and bloodshed. And it's at this point that the comedy turns to tragedy. If you've seen Goodnight Desdemona, Good Morning Juliet, you know that Constance Leadbelly, the academic from Queens who's writing her thesis on how Romeo and Juliet is really a comedy, intervenes right at this moment. This is the moment where you can change the course of events. You can keep it a comedy if only you can stop this moment from happening. So she intervenes and says, "Wait, you're cousins, don't kill each other." And then the play goes off in another direction. Well, that doesn't happen here. There's no Constance Leadbelly. The greatest punster, the most skillful verbal duelist, dies in 3-1, and the play changes entirely when he is gone. The death of Mercutio removes one of the most powerfully moving and attractive characters in the play, arguably in Shakespeare's entire canon. Without Mercutio, the world of the play is quite different. Mercutio has always refused to take Romeo seriously. He teases him mercilessly about Rosaline, about his bad poetry. "Now is he for the numbers that Petrarch flowed in," he says. And I wonder, what would Mercutio have thought of Juliet? It's a strange thing to think that Mercutio dies without ever learning about his friend's new love. The most important character in the play, other than Romeo and Juliet, doesn't know what everyone for the last 400 years has known. It's tempting to wonder if he would have behaved differently in the duel scene had he known. Would he have been more conciliatory? Although it is a fallacy to fall into the trap of imagining him as a real person. I like to think he would have recognized this love as the real thing. Why? Because the currency of this play is language. If you think that this love is precipitous, you have to look at the language. And when Romeo meets Juliet, his poetry becomes incandescent. He goes from clichés to stunningly original images. It has to be love because he becomes a poet. And in Shakespeare's world, that was valuable. So he goes from hackneyed patriarchanisms about freezing and frying at the same time to sublimely original images. Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. It seems she hangs upon the cheek of night as a rich jewel in an Ethiop's ear. Ah, stunningly visual. All right, last thoughts, settings. Productions often set Romeo and Juliet in a time or a place of political or racial strife, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, black-white, antebellum American North-South, Bosnian-Serbian, Christian-Muslim. There's no shortage of potential settings in our world, unfortunately. Such settings offer a reason for the feud and often perform valuable political commentary. But it's worth remembering that Shakespeare never tells us why the Montagues and Capulets hate each other. The chorus tells us that ancient grudge breaks to new mutiny. Why? What caused the ancient grudge? Why is it broken out again? It's the ancient grudge that creates the social divisions in the play. In fact, the Capulets and Montagues are both alike in dignity. They have the same social status. Both families are wealthy. Both families are respected. Paris notes that they are both of honorable reckoning. It's a pity you lived at odds so long. You get the sense that the parents would have been arranging a marriage for Romeo and Juliet themselves had things been different. So it's not that social or racial divisions create conflict in the world of Verona. The conflict itself creates and perpetuates division. And this is a very important distinction to make. The point is that hatred is an intense, irrational passion in this play, just as love is. The play juxtaposes intense hatred with intense love. Equally disconnected from reason, equally fatal, both are devouring abstractions. Example, Juliet, on discovering that the boy she has just kissed is a Montague. My only love sprung from my only hate. Too early seen, unknown, and known too late. If she'd known whom he was earlier, she would have hated him with the same intensity that she now loves him. Well, he's the ideal match for her. Appropriate age, appropriate social status, even Capulet knows what a nice young man Romeo has turned out to be and says so at the mask in order to prevent Tybalt from challenging him on the spot and wrecking the house. There's no sense, there's no foundation to this feud. The futility of violence is undermined by its apparent lack of motive. So I think what this play wants us to think about in the end is that love can transcend hatred because the enemy is lovable if you don't see him as the enemy to begin with. Hatred is not inevitable, nor is it innate. Thank you. Enjoy the show.